This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Did you know that CoverGirl now has its first gender-fluid makeup model? Modern Family has a transgender child in a mainstream sitcom, and Transparent has won a Golden Globe Award. Yet despite these incredible headlines, transgender children and their parents rarely have reliable support or codified best practices to deal with new challenges. When every commenter on the internet is ready to declare themselves an expert on how gender-variant children should be raised and treated, it's kind of hard for parents to know where to turn for reliable, calm guidance backed by sound science. I am by no means an expert in this field, but I do happen to know a couple of experts, and we're going to be talking with both of them in this part of today's show. They've written a book about raising transgender children. It's fascinating stuff, full of all sorts of things I had never even heard of or thought about. For example, how you might be able to recognize signs that your child could be transgender, why children don't grow out of their gender identity, how to support your child and give him or her the unconditional love they deserve, even if you're a little bit confused about what you feel, and also mourning the loss of a child that you never actually had. I'm Armin Brott. We'll be talking about all that and a lot more when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom.
I go to school with your children.
We say the Pledge of Allegiance together.
You see me around the neighborhood and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every five children in America and I'm struggling with hunger.
This problem is closer than you think. My teacher tells me we could grow up to be whatever we want.
I want to grow up to be someone who doesn't go to bed hungry.
There's enough food in this country to feed everybody.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me, quietly struggling with hunger.
Together, we are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guests for this part of today's show are Elisa Bowman and Michelle Angelo, who together are the co-authors of a book called Raising the Transgender Child, a Complete Guide for Parents, Families, and Caregivers. Elisa, Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
pleasure.
So I think we probably need to do a little bit of background here because the whole topic of transgender is getting to be something that spends a lot of time on people's minds. I guess it's in the media all over the place, but I'm not sure people really completely understand what it is and how widespread it is or whether it is that widespread at all. So can you give us just a little bit of a background of the extent of the issue?
Sure. This is Michelle. We don't have specific or real empirical data on demographics and numbers for transgender people, but we do know that the numbers are certainly increasing, and I've witnessed over the 17 years of practice a significant shift in the number of people who are coming out and the number of people who are coming out earlier in life. When I started my practice, it was I was seeing almost exclusively adults, and typically adults over the age of 30, and now I'm seeing people ranging in age from as young as 3 to as, they call it life experience, as 83 in my practice right now. And it's full-time. This is all that I do at the moment, and that wasn't how it started out.
So do you think it's more awareness that's enabling people to come out in this way, or is it that there's something else that's going on that's causing it to happen?
I don't think it's anything, I don't think it's anything in the water. I think it's really more just there is much more mainstream media and scientific attention to the topic and to the community. And so people are understanding themselves much earlier in life than they were before, and that the parents are understanding that this is a real thing that their child is experiencing, and so they're willing to look at it with their child at a much earlier age.
Okay, so what is it when you talk about it, it's a real thing? So what does that mean exactly? It's a real thing that a boy, somebody who's born as a biological boy, would say, "I just don't feel like a boy." Or what's going on in there? What are you talking about it being a thing?
Well, we attempted to cover everything from a person who was assigned male at birth who identifies as a female to people who are exploring their gender and looking at it from a spectrum. So maybe they don't necessarily feel as if their body and their brain are congruent with one another, but they don't necessarily feel as if they want to transition from one gender, you know, from male to female. And so we call those folks, you know, gender expansive or gender fluid or non-binary.
Okay. And you said the age ranges from, that sounded like 3 to 83, or use that as a ballpark. 3 just seems so young for a child to have firm beliefs about almost anything, especially something that is so abstract in a way as gender.
It does. You're absolutely right. And yet, a lot of these kids, and I'm using that number kind of anecdotally because that's the youngest I'm seeing in my practice at this point.
Right.
I've had kids even younger coming in saying, you know, barely verbal, "I a boy," if they were assigned female at birth. So it's really the kids when they acquire some more definitive verbal skills who will come in at 3 and be often demanding that their sex assigned at birth is not accurate with their identity. So it's difficult, and I understand how parents and folks who are outside of the community think 3 is too young for a kid to make a decision about anything for themselves. But for some of these kids who are coming in, they're either in a significant amount of pain, or they're just so certain that they don't understand why everybody else isn't seeing it as well.
No, I'm just thinking
Go ahead.
Oh,
yeah. Because you know, my son is 12 now. And so when he was 3, though, he was already showing signs that he wasn't the girl that I thought he was. And these signs are a lot more telling than just a child who isn't like the stereotypical child. So you hear a lot of people say, "Well, why can't girls just be masculine?" And they can. But I had a child who would tell me that the girls' clothing department, for instance, was the wrong place to be shopping because that's not my department. Or the girls' bathroom is the wrong bathroom. That's not my bathroom. Sleeping topless or asking for boxer shorts. These are things that tomboys don't generally do. So I think there are some things that kind of stand out with, you know, this is a child. This is about identity and not just about you know, the clothes that you wear or how you wear your hair, things like that. It goes a lot deeper. And I, as a parent, thought, well, you know, maybe my kid will just grow out of this. What does my kid know at this age? But, you know, kids at that age do know their gender. They're splitting each other up into groups. They can tell you which friends are girls, which friends are boys, and they tell you who they are in those categories. And so we never question a 3-year-old who was assigned, let's say, female at birth. We never question her when she tells you she's a girl, and we don't say, "Oh, she's too young to know." We only question it when they fall outside of the norms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but even as a parent, I thought, "Oh, it's too young," right? And then as my son grew older and time went by, I started kind of looking back and realizing he always knew who he was. I was the person who was doubting it.
All right. So I'm just was thinking, as you're saying all this, about my oldest daughter, who's 26, and she's heterosexual as far as I know. But when she was 18 months old, I showed her the movie Oliver Twist. And she, after that, for the next year and a half, really and truly, was Oliver. We had to call her Oliver. She only wore boys' clothes and a nice, you know, little hat that we got. And everybody else in the family had certain roles assigned to them as well. Would that have been something that somebody might have been worried about at some point? Because it just never occurred to me. And this is, of course, I think long before transgender was something, a topic of conversation. But it never occurred to me for a moment that was anything other than just a kid with an imagination.
Right, and we hear various examples of that as we're talking about this topic and as we were writing this book. I also have a daughter who's 27. Who changed her name for 9 months. You know, it was a complete shift of the name that I gave her, and I didn't have a doubt that she would eventually come around, and not that this is nearly as critical as gender, it's not, but that she would eventually come around. I knew she would. I knew that this was just a thing. She really liked the name. It was that of some superhero that she'd seen on television. And one day she just said, "You can stop calling me that name now. You can go back to calling me Mara." And the difference in that is she did not exhibit any level of psychological distress or discomfort. It was just, "Hey, I really like this name. Could you call me this name?" And she didn't shift her identity. She didn't change the way that she reacted or engaged with me. She wasn't upset that people who were not in our little family loop, that this was the new name, still called her by her birth name. But transgender kids or gender expansive kids, they generally are upset about that. I hear it all the time. You know, for example, if a parent says, "Well, you're assigned female at birth, just when we're in public, you have to use the girls' bathroom or the women's bathroom." And I hear young children say, "But then everybody's going to think that I'm a girl, and that's wrong." Hmm. So that's pretty different than, you know, taking on a role or changing a name, or as in your case, you know, having somebody pretend to be a character.
I'm talking with Michelle Angelo and Elisa Bowman, who are the co-authors of Raising the Transgender Child, A Complete Guide for Parents, Families, and Caregivers. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep talking to Michelle and Elisa.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, talking with Michelle Angelo and Elisa Bowman, who are the co-authors of Raising the Transgender Child, A Complete Guide for Parents, Families, and Caregivers. I would imagine that you get a lot of parents coming in who are feeling guilty or feeling that they've done something wrong. How do you talk to parents who just are so, they just don't know what to do? I mean, I would imagine most people have never dealt with this, but somebody who is dealing with it must feel completely helpless.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I say to parents early on is, this is just one of those topics. It's one of the few topics in parenting where we can't go to our best friend or our neighbor and say, "How did you handle it when your child did X?" Because most of the times they don't know another parent who's experienced a child who is who has transitioned or is interested in transitioning. So you're absolutely right. The other thing that parents will often say is, They want to know causation. They want to know if they did something to make this be. Was I not masculine enough? Was I not feminine enough? Did I not teach my kid, you know, quote unquote, appropriate gender roles and expressions? And it's universal. I expect the question. And if they're not explicit in their articulation of that question, I'll say to them, have you thought about your role in this? And they'll say, oh my God, that's all I've thought about. What did I do? What could I do differently? And then my job at that point is really to reassure them that none of us, no matter how skilled or manipulative we are, can make somebody be transgender. It just can't happen. Even if you are the most manipulative person in the world, it's not going to stick for somebody who's not trans.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do anything, and the thing that they're doing incredibly right is allowing their kid to explore safely and recognizing that they'll figure this out, and that there's
right.
nothing that they're going to do to steer them one way or the other. I mean, it used to break my heart. It happens so much less now, thankfully, but it used to break my heart when I started seeing trans kids, and I have to spend the first, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 sessions convincing the parent that their child was worthy of their unconditional love, even as they were questioning their gender.
Right. I was going to say that you're saying you can't make somebody transgender, but at the same time, you also can't cure them, so to speak,
correct.
Of that. So what do you tell parents about how to support a child who's going through this? I mean, I'm trying to stay away from the word like contrary, but it just seems to be contrary in a way to what we expect as parents. You know, we're going to be raising a fine young lady or a nice young man or something. And to have this happen, it makes you question all sorts of stuff, not whether you did it necessarily or not, but whether it's even okay and what you do about it. So how do you even begin to have these conversations with people who are not only concerned that they might have done something wrong, but that they just don't know even what to do at all? It just seems like a completely paralyzing type of... I'm imagining this. You correct me if I'm wrong.
Do you want to take that, Elisa?
Yeah, you know, I think we as parents, we go through stages of grief just as people do when they lose anything that they were really attached to, whether it's a human or an object. In this case, it's a human. And, you know, when you have a child, you have all of these dreams. Sometimes you're not even conscious of the things that you're dreaming for that child that a lot never materialize. You know, many parents dream that their children are going to grow up to be a certain profession or that they'll share common interests with their parents and maybe stay in a religion and their children don't, or a lot of parents have children who end up being the opposite political party of them. There's all sorts of ways that our children turn out differently than we think they're going to be when we give birth to them. And giving birth to a transgender child, I think, at least for me, kind of fell into that. It made me aware of all of these hopes and dreams that I had that I didn't even realize I had until I was faced with this, wow, I thought I was raising a girl, but I'm really raising a boy. And, you know, you grieve that for a while. 'Cause especially for us, we thought, you know, we were raising only one child, so it wasn't like I had any other children that could still fulfill my whatever expectations of what I thought raising a girl would be like. So it was really like saying goodbye to this idea of the child that I thought I was raising. Now, looking back on it, I know I was never actually raising the child that I thought I was raising, right? It was all this fantasy in my mind.
Sure.
But I still had to grieve that.
Yeah.
And then also welcome the child that I do have, who's actually a really awesome kid. But it takes time. It's not like that happens overnight. So
mm-hmm.
you do go through that, and there's fear, fear that society won't accept your child, fear that you're going to lose your friends, fear that your neighbors are going to be talking about you behind your back. I mean, the fears go on and on and on.
Yeah,
and
well, some of those are probably pretty real.
You eventually get through all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's also upsides. You know, I've made new friends over this whole journey, and I have to say they're probably, like, closer friendships than I had before. So, you know, I mean, we don't always question our friendships and our family. They sort of become attached to us.
Right.
And when you go through something like this, you find out who your real friends were and who they really weren't, and you say goodbye to a few people, but then you inherit this whole new family that is really there for you.
So you mentioned grief, and you mentioned also something I was just thinking about, about supporting your kid, but not just supporting, but also just the fear of not being able to protect your child. I think even when you're dealing with the questions of unconditional love and how difficult that must be, I think deep down inside, most parents want to protect their child physically and emotionally. And that's a hard thing to do. We're not equipped for that kind of thing. I mean, it's hard enough for a kid who's going to, you know, wears glasses or is overweight or, you know, whatever, has dyslexia or some sort of a disability that's going to get you picked on and pushed around in school. But something like using a different bathroom or coming in and you're not a girl anymore, that's just like off the charts.
Yeah. I would argue, though, that, you know, all parents have this fear of their children. And I say that because I remember what it felt like to bring my son to school the first day schools were open after the Sandy Hook shooting, and dropping him off and feeling completely out of control and realizing that I had to trust other people to protect him when I wasn't there. And now he was an elementary school kid back then, so I had this, I guess, this greater sense of having to protect him than I do now because he's a little bit older. But I think all parents feel that at different times, where we realize we're not as all-powerful as we'd like to be, and that makes us, you know, it's a very disconcerting feeling. But at the same time, I have looked at it as, what do I need to teach my son so that he can grow into a strong, confident person who is capable of protecting himself and also having a strong sense of emotional resilience? And those are things that really I think all parents would want their kids to have. It's just that maybe my kid needs those things earlier and more often. So, you know, I can't expect to get him through life without a bully or two. And I can't expect to get him through life without seeing a really hurtful comment, for instance, on the internet. Or, you know, something on the TV or all of these other places where people are sort of, they are attacking transgender people. But I can expect that I can teach him that he is completely loved and he is completely normal and he's an awesome human being. And I think if I do that, he'll have the confidence that he needs to weather those storms.
Michelle Angelo and Elisa Bowman are the co-authors of Raising the Transgender Child, A Complete Guide for Parents, Families, and Caregivers. Michelle or Elisa, is either one of you or both of you have a website where people can get a little bit more information about this?
Sure. So my website is www.michelleangelo.com.
Michelle with one L.
Michelle with one L and Angelo with two L.
Okay. All right. Michelle and Elisa, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
If we could pack our kids in bubble wrap, we'd do it because we love them and we want to protect them. This is Lisa Edelstein with an easy way to protect your kids three times a day. Choose healthy foods. Research has shown that a vegetarian diet rich in fruits and vegetables can help protect our kids against obesity. It can even help keep them from developing heart disease or cancer when they grow up. To learn more, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt, and it's time for a Parents at Play segment. And because playing with your kids, no matter how old they are, is always a blast, Here are some great ways to start blasting with your kids. Laser X two-player laser gaming set from NSI International. There are a lot of words to describe Laser X, but to keep the list short, we're going to limit ourselves to wow, amazing, cool, woohoo, and most importantly, let's do it again. Got the point there? We reviewed the two-player set, which, if you're a laser newbie, is the only way to go. Playing against someone else is infinitely more fun than playing by yourself. This set comes with two laser blasters, two vests, an interactive coach who tells you to get down and lets you know when you're running low on ammo, cool sound effects, and hours of fun. It's great for outdoors or indoors, and since the vests and the blasters glow, it's especially fun at night. It's also compatible with other LaserX equipment, so you can field teams. Each vest allows you to select red team, blue team, or to go rogue and blast everyone in sight. It's for ages 6 to 16, $24.99 for a single blaster and vest, and $49.99 for a double set at major retailers or getlaserx.com. Skypaper PPL-1 from The Bridge Direct. Making paper airplanes is a great parent-child activity with opportunities for both cooperative and competitive play, but there is nothing more frustrating than tossing your newly created aircraft and having it nosedive 3 feet in front of you. With the paper PPL-1, that'll never happen. Instead, you'll be able to launch your planes up to 100 feet. It comes with 24 planes and easy-to-follow instructions. You can download even more at skypapertoys.com. It's for ages 6 and up. Costs under $20 at Toys R Us and other retailers. Firetech Zyklone Ring Launcher from Zing. This double-take-provoking shooter is pretty much the opposite of most other blaster-type toys. Instead of shooting an object at a target, you're essentially launching the target itself. In this case, it's a large glowing ring. Since you can send the ring up to 100 feet, this anti-blaster is best for outdoor play. It's for ages 6 and up, costs about $30. It's available only at Target. The Air Warriors Ultra Tech Blasters from Buzzbee Toys. Buzzbee makes a dizzying variety of blasters. The Night Tech fires darts up to 72 feet. It comes with 6 long-distance suction darts and can use long-distance and foam darts from other shooters. What's especially cool is the pop-up night vision scope, which allows you to see your target day or night. Destiny is another model. Doesn't launch its darts as far, it's only 60 feet, but it can unload 20 rounds in just 2 seconds. Just load the clip, snap it in, pump the handle, and whoosh! Both are for ages 6 and up. The Night Tech requires batteries and retails for about $13. Destiny does not need batteries and retails for under $28. Adventure Force Enforcer Belt Blaster from Walmart. This fully automatic belt-driven monster is one of the most unique-looking blasters we've seen, and it'll strike fear into the hearts of your less-equipped blaster battle opponents. It's accurate and quick, shooting 40 darts in under 30 seconds, and has an 80-foot range. It assembles fairly quickly, but takes some time to load up the darts. However, firing it is exhilarating. Batteries are required. It costs about $30, and it's for ages 8 and up. You can get it at walmart.com. Magnum Super Drum Blaster from Primetime Toys. Primetime's Magnum is fully automatic, holds 40 darts, and has a range of 80 feet, and is pretty intimidating. What's nice is that its darts work with other Dart Zone blasters and can hold darts from other brands. It's for ages 8 and up. Costs under $35 at major retailers. You can get more information at primetimetoys.com. And speaking of more information, you can get a lot more reviews of toys and games at our website, parentsatplay.com. And of course, if you've got a comment or suggestion, you can drop us a line also through parentsatplay.com. We'll be back next week with another segment for you. Hey, but don't go quite yet. You know that there's much more positive parenting coming right up.
More with Mr. Dad. Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Ever notice when you have a baby, everyone seems to give you advice? From your mother-in-law,
don't you know you can't take that baby out in the rain today?
And where is her hat?
To your own parents.
You should take the baby outside every day, even in the rain.
To your friends.
You have got to get this diaper cream. It is so much better than the one you've been using.
When it comes to the important stuff, like immunizations and protecting my baby's health, I trust my baby's doctor. She really listens to my questions about shots, she gives me great information, and she works with me to make sure my baby gets protected. And that's something even my mother-in-law can agree with.
Honey, I totally support you getting the baby vaccinated, but really, shouldn't you put the baby's hat back on?
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
I'm Armin Brott. This is the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. We're glad you stayed with us. Dr. James Greenblatt has seen thousands of children and young adults struggling with the symptoms of ADHD, inattentiveness, impulsiveness, hyperactivity, and often irritability or combativeness. However, rather than simply prescribing medication for their ADHD symptoms, Dr. Greenblatt tailors remedies to his patients' individual needs. He detects and treats their underlying causes of the disorder. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Dr. Greenblatt about some of the proven natural methods that he uses to treat problems, talking about things like nutritional deficiencies of magnesium or zinc, a condition called dysbiosis, which is a microbial imbalance inside the body, sleeping difficulties and food allergies, all of which, unbeknownst to a lot of people, can cause or exacerbate the symptoms of ADHD. He's put all of this into what he calls the plus-minus healing plan, and we're going to be talking about every single step of that. The goal of it is pretty simple. Once you understand the reasons behind your child's symptoms, you'll be able to eliminate them, whether they're on medication or not. And if medication is necessary, this approach will actually help to minimize the side effects. If you're the parent of a child with ADHD, or you've got it yourself, which is a perfectly good possibility, I think I do, you're not going to want to miss this show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is James Greenblatt, who's the author of Finally Focused, the Breakthrough Natural Treatment Plan for ADHD that restores attention, minimizes hyperactivity, helps eliminate drug side effects. James, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be on the show.
So let's talk a little bit about how ADHD is traditionally diagnosed and treated, and then we'll start getting into your very different approach.
Sure. I think, you know, if we had a second to go back 100 years, we've been using similar names to describe kids with attention and behavior problems, and every 10 or 20 years, we kind of change the name, which means we change the treatment approach. And right now, the current approach to diagnosing ADHD is just a behavioral checklist, a list of symptoms, including overactivity and impulsivity and inattention. And it's a pretty subjective list. We don't have any medical or biological tests. So the doctors, the psychologists are making these lists and making a diagnosis, and typical treatment has been with medications.
Does it start off with a kind of diagnosis from a teacher who says this kid is too active, is running around, whatever, and then that, do you think that that has a tendency possibly to bias the medical person who finally gets a hold of the kid later on?
The diagnosis really comes from kind of all sorts. For some of the males, for the boys, oftentimes they're identified early in school as being hyperactive or disruptive or hard to sit still. Some of the girls are not as hyperactive, which means they're just inattentive, and they might not get picked up till much later, middle school or high school. Sometimes these kids are getting all A's in school, so the schools have no concern, but the symptoms are only evident at home or on the sports field. So they really come diagnosed, or the symptoms can appear in different environments, and that's why someone years ago used the word, rather than attention deficit, wanted to change it to variable attention deficit disorder, because there are different environments.
Well, yeah, I mean, we hear that kids who have attention deficit disorder, whether it's ADHD or ADD, just whichever one is the flavor of the month, that they can actually focus quite well in certain circumstances. And that's kind of what you're talking about, which I think a lot of people find confusing. I mean, you'd think if you have attention deficit disorder, you would be having some attention issues everywhere.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's confusing for professionals and parents. And that's why the concept of variable attention, I think, is really important, because it doesn't mean because they're getting all A's in science that they don't have attentional issues and might need help in other areas.
Okay. And so how is your approach to diagnosing different, or is it?
Well, the approach to diagnosing is not that different. I'm looking for the same children and adults that are struggling with problems with attention, focus. One term that I like is persistence of effort and motivation. And then if those symptoms are getting in the way in some aspect of their life, could be school, could be home, my treatment is just a little different. And I've been, you know, prescribing medications for 30 years, so if needed, I use medicines. But what we have found over the years is that many of these kids have metabolic, nutritional, sleep problems, other kind of related problems that could be contributing to the symptoms. And my goal is to look to see if we can find and treat those problems before we use medicine.
Okay. And so you use what you call the plus-minus treatment plan, which is talking about too much of some things and not enough of something else's. Is that just, I mean, the quick and dirty way of summing it up?
Yeah, that was the simplest model that I could think of, because
okay.
Every child is different, and
yeah.
We needed to make a big list on either side.
Right. And so we're not probably going to be able to get through all of them, but let's talk about some of the big ones. I think you hear a lot about magnesium these days, often in conjunction with dairy products, and that you need more magnesium in order to properly metabolize the dairy products. But what is the connection between magnesium and ADHD?
You know, I think in 30 years of practice, probably the most consistent finding that I've seen is a magnesium deficiency in kids with ADHD. And the research is so clear and scientific-based, it's one of the topics that I feel very comfortable discussing with, you know, physicians and pediatricians, helping them understand that research. So magnesium deficiency, some of it could be related to the high dairy and calcium content. Some of it, I think, is genetic, and some of it is due to stress. When stress levels go up, magnesium is kind of excreted from the body, but it is the most common deficiency that we see.
So there's a difference, of course, between causation and correlation, right? So does the fact that kids with ADHD have a deficiency of magnesium mean that that's what's causing it?
It's certainly contributing to some of the symptoms, because we've been treating kids with magnesium for many years, and there's research looking at this as well. And many of the symptoms get better. Some of the hyperactivity, some of the sleep disturbances improve on magnesium. And we can test for magnesium deficiency. So the other really important point is that, you know, 10 kids all 10 years of age with ADHD, if you put, they might not all have magnesium as the core nutritional deficiency, but many will.
Okay, and that's just something you can ask your pediatrician next time that he's ordering a blood panel? Or is it more complicated than that?
We look at blood. Red blood cell magnesium is one way of detecting it. There's also hair samples. Nutritional levels of trace minerals sometimes can be picked up in the hair. So both ways can be helpful.
Okay. And are there other symptoms that parents might be on the lookout for that might point them in the direction of a magnesium problem? Or is it just something that if you have a child with ADD or ADHD, that you just want to attack that as a possibility right from the start?
You pretty much want to read about it and attack it right from the start. But there are four symptoms that are common that go with magnesium deficiency. So one is, I mentioned earlier, insomnia, so kids that have sleep problems. Two, which is not uncommon in our kids with ADHD, is constipation. Three would be irritability and anxiety. So those are the four kinds of symptoms that we see with magnesium deficiency. And it doesn't mean taking a pill for the first week that it's going to get better, but most of the time over the course of 30 days of just a supplementation with magnesium, some of those symptoms will improve.
Now, is magnesium typically something you can get from food, or is it something that you really need to get from a supplement?
You certainly can get magnesium from food, whole foods. It's certainly in the whole grains. It's in our green vegetables. It's in all those healthy foods we tell our kids to eat. I do think for the kids that we've been seeing for so many years with ADHD, to really make a difference, probably need to use a nutritional supplement of magnesium in addition to the whole foods.
Okay. So while we're on the topic of minerals, I guess we'll call them, what about lithium? You know, when I hear lithium and I started reading this, I thought, wait, we're talking about bipolar, because I think lithium was one of the, or still is, a drug of choice for treating bipolar issues. How does that fit in with ADD and ADHD?
Well, so my work is looking at lithium as a nutritional trace mineral. So lithium is in the soil. Almost every glass of tap water we would drink would have small amounts of lithium in it. So, and in our bottled water from mineral springs. So lithium has been on the planet for billions of years and has essential functions in the brain. And we've just found a subset of kids, particularly the more aggressive, impulsive. Some of the kids we hear about, they get kicked out of preschool, and parents are doing everything they can. We have found that just providing small amounts of nutritional lithium, lithium that you can get over-the-counter on Amazon, has been incredibly helpful for that small subset. It's not a medication, and it's not the same strength lithium that you would get in a prescription. It's just what's in our water supply that's put into supplements.
Talking with James Greenblatt, who's the author of Finally Focused. It's a breakthrough natural treatment plan for ADHD. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking to James about, well, I'm going to ask a few more questions about lithium, but also some of the minus issues. We've been talking about plus things, meaning you need to get more of, but there's also some things you might have too much of. I'm Armin Braun, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Greenblatt, who's the author of Finally Focused, the breakthrough natural treatment plan for ADHD that restores attention, minimizes hyperactivity, helps eliminate drug side effects. Wanted to get back a little bit to lithium, because you mentioned that it's not nearly the quantities or the concentration that you're talking about for somebody who's got the bipolar issues that I mentioned. And what sorts of foods do you get that in? Or again, is that a supplement that you need?
Most of our lithium supply is actually in the soil, so it's from the water we're drinking. And with our obsession over the past 25 years with bottled water and filtered water, that some people believe that might be why there's more of a nutritional deficiency in lithium. It's not in meat. It's mostly in whole grains and vegetables. I believe that we all have different requirements for lithium, and those families with psychiatric problems like drug abuse, depression, or even bipolar in a relative, often these are the kids that, even though they don't have those major psychiatric illnesses, tend to do better with a little more lithium in their diet.
And is that something that can be tested for, like magnesium, or is there some other way of determining that?
The only test, and I've been using the same test again for 30 years, is a hair mineral analysis. So just like on TV where they look at levels of drugs and heavy metals, you can detect lithium. And I've been looking at the same test again for so many years, and the last 10 or 15 years, the levels are getting less and less, and oftentimes we have kids with what we call undetectable lithium in their hair samples. And those are the kids we would use nutritional supplements of lithium with.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about some of the minus issues. And the first one actually is kind of a pairing. You've got minus on, an excess of copper and a deficiency of zinc. What's the connection between the two of those metals?
Well, you know, we've been reading a lot about the lead crisis in Flint and the water. And recent studies actually done here in Massachusetts looked at the same schools, and not only was lead high, but copper is high. So copper is in all the old pipes we use, copper pipes, and high copper is one of the causes we've seen of hyperactivity and aggressive behavior in children. It's mostly environmental and easily detected. Oftentimes can take a while to treat, and the trace mineral zinc is the treatment for high copper. They're kind of a seesaw balance. One mineral balances the other. So if we do see high copper, we would just try to eliminate copper in the environment and add zinc.
Wait, how does zinc affect copper?
Again, if you add zinc, copper, they compete with the same kind of proteins in the blood. So as zinc levels go up, copper levels go down.
Huh.
There are some genetic disorders of high copper, and the medication is just using high zinc.
Wow.
We've known this for many years, but with these hyperactive children, our pediatricians aren't routinely looking for it. That's been the problem.
You know, that's fascinating. I years ago in a home remodel did some plumbing work and was told very, very forcefully to not mix copper and galvanized pipe. That caused a bad chemical reaction. So there was some sort of, if you had copper and galvanized pipes, you had to have some sort of something in between the two of them so that they wouldn't touch. I wonder if that's the same kind of a problem, or the same kind of thing that's going on inside the body, some sort of a chemical reaction that's causing erosion, basically.
Well, similar, and copper has very key, important effects in brain chemistry, and so you need small amounts of copper to make some of the neurotransmitters in the brain, like dopamine, but too much copper kind of stimulates excessive amount of some of these chemicals, and that's where you get that kind of irritability or hyperactivity.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about medication, because that's one of the things that I think there's a lot of people these days who are saying that kids are over-medicated, and I think you're certainly one of them. What are the alternatives to medication?
Well, I think what's really critically important to me, and the reason I wrote this book now, is the use of medications in our younger kids, these 4 to 6 and 7-year-old kids being put on medicines without looking at any other kind of medical treatments. And I think, to me, that's a real tragedy, because oftentimes the kinds of things we talk about, be it food allergies or nutritional deficiencies, in these younger kids, those we can make a huge difference. I found some kids do benefit from medicine, but it's after, you know, all these nutritional deficiencies and usually later on in school if they're really struggling. The other component of the book is that I'm not anti-medicine. I believe it's kind of overprescribed and people aren't looking at the big picture. If medicine is used, a lot of the nutritional interventions, particularly the magnesium that we talked about, can eliminate a lot of the side effects that patients and our children complain about.
Okay. Now, you have an interesting thing here because we talk about the sugar drinks and kids are eating too much garbage and there's too much sugar. And I think there's a lot of acknowledgement out there that there's sugar is leading to inflammation and it causes all sorts of problems. But you're talking about not necessarily getting rid of it completely, but adding protein. And is that a similar type of way as adding zinc to counteract the excess of copper? So you would be adding protein to counteract the sugar? Or should you just get off the sugar?
I'd want refined sugar to be removed from the planet. We would all do better.
We probably
would.
But
I've talked to enough parents where, you know, they take everything out of the house and the kids do fine for 2 weeks and then they're sneaking out. And so part of the message is, you know, helping our kids learn to eat better, make better choices. And there was one study that was done years ago, but I continue to talk about it, is where they gave the effects of sugar by itself really affected attention and reading. And if they gave protein with the sugar, it did not have the same effect on attention. And so in the book, without trying to be kind of fanatic in enraging parents or kids, I tried to just help parents understand that increasing protein is going to minimize the amount of refined carbohydrates in the diet and minimize that effect. And there's research to support that.
Yeah. So when you said that they didn't have the same effect, does that mean that it completely eliminated it or it reduced some of the problems that were associated with sugar?
In this one study, it completely eliminated the attentional problems that they measured. In the old days, you know, pediatricians used to quote a couple of studies that said sugar didn't contribute to hyperactivity. And I think the newer research, you're not going to get a simple cause and effect, but over time, refined sugar contributes to nutritional deficiencies,
sure,
which then affects, you know, brain chemistry. And for some individuals, the refined sugar immediately affects behavior.
And is it a particular type of protein? Does it matter if it's a piece of chicken or a plate full of beans?
No, it does not matter.
Huh, that's just fascinating. Okay. So there's another pairing that I like that I think is something we've talked about on the show, and I think something that requires some, you can never say it too often, about the not kids not getting enough sleep, needing more sleep, and also needing more exercise. Talk about the connection there.
Well, another term, you know, I like, other than, you know, besides variable attention disorder, some of the headlines in the New York Times a few years ago, a sleep deficit disorder. The relationship between sleep disturbances in young children associated with ADHD years later and the association with sleep problems in current kids with ADHD is really quite high. So we tend to kind of ignore the effect of sleep on attention, but the research is quite clear, so enough sleep is critical. And then, you know, the other two parts of treatment involve, one, exercise. Many adults know that's when they focus the best and to pay attention. And when now we have research in kids, both, you know, physical exercise as well as some of the yoga, mind-body kind of approaches can really make a difference in attention that is long-lasting.
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of studies. I actually saw some really interesting ones about kids who had exercise in the morning that they tended to do better on tests and all sorts of performance throughout the rest of the day. So, talking with James Greenblatt, who's the author of Finally Focused, the Breakthrough Natural Treatment Plan for ADHD that restores attention, minimizes hyperactivity, and helps eliminate drug side effects. James, thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.